On this episode of Sophisticated Property Investing from Ethical Property Partners.
I went through the numbers with them and said, look, you know, I'm probably thinking this is going to work something like this. You'll receive £350,000. I'll do the refurbishment and then we'll split the profit over and above that once I've got my refurbishment money back.
Welcome to this Sophisticated Property Investing special. It's the Deal Spotlight.
Mr. Ian Taylor, welcome to the podcast, sir. How are you on this fine sunny day?
Top form. Thank you, Frank. How are you?
I'm excited about getting into the guts of this deal. This is a new format episode for us, so we haven't been doing this before. But in a nutshell, we are going to be picking individual deals that our EPP partners have been doing, and we're going to be really going into depth, finding out everything from the very start, how our partners came across these deals, all the way through to how they negotiated them, how they protected themselves legally, how they did the deal, and then how they monetized it afterwards. And I was thinking about this before, and this will make you laugh. I was thinking you're really the grandfather of EPP.
I'm sure there's a compliment in there somewhere, Frank. Thank you.
It means you're wise, I think, Ian. That's what it means exactly. But you are extremely experienced, being in property for 20 plus years. You've got a really good sized portfolio, residential and commercial experience. So I won't take away your thunder, but suffice to say, we are starting with a fantastic deal with a fantastic partner. And yeah, let's kick off. How about we start by you just introducing yourself, Ian, and telling the guys a little bit about your experience?
My background is I've been involved in property, as you've rightly said, for about 23 years. I studied estate surveying at university in Nottingham, finished there in 1997. And my first job was, it was kind of my dream job, actually. I landed a job in Newbury in Berkshire working for a commercial property investment company as an asset manager. And that job, in a nutshell, simply was adding value to a very large and diverse portfolio of commercial properties worth, at the time, I think it was about £160 million. And my job was to increase the value of those properties through any number of means. That was extending leases. It was doing refurbishments of void space. It was finding development opportunities, increasing rents through rent reviews and a variety of other methods. So I did that for a few years and became an independent asset management consultant after that, actually, for one of the clients that we used to work with. Did that for a little while, which took me through to about 2005, 2006, and then started buying residential property, almost by accident, actually. I started buying off plan originally and then came across a small group of people who were doing some advertising for people who wanted to sell quickly. And the portfolio just kind of grew and grew from there, really. So between 2005 and 2009, I bought, I guess, I think about 98, 99 residential properties. Still have a number of those now. And then I just kind of went on a little bit of a wandering journey from there, really. I did a little bit of development, did some service accommodation, got into trading Forex for my sins at one point and all sorts of online schemes and scams, and then came across you. Was it about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, I guess? And that brings us up to date.
I was just working it out in my head, Ian. To do 98, 99 properties in 4 years, I think that's 2 a month. That's one a fortnight, which is incredible over that period of time. How many do you actually own and control now? How many properties?
61 at the moment.
Fantastic, fantastic. And in terms of this particular deal that we're going to be talking about today, is that one of your core strategies? Is that a new strategy that you're getting into? How does it fit within the larger portfolio and the larger SPI business?
It's something that I made a conscious decision to do about a year or so ago. I decided that I needed to generate chunks of cash, and development is something that I've always wanted to do more of. I've touched on it before, done it very badly in the past, actually, as well. And this almost kind of came to me by accident, actually. I had done some assisted sales and really liked assisted sales. They were very good for me. And this came to me as simply a BMV deal, to be honest. And it just kind of grew arms and legs from there. And it's now moved into what it is at the moment.
So what I'd like to do, Ian, on this particular deal is start right at the start and then go through it chronologically, step by step, as to what you did, what went well, what didn't go so well, and where you've got to. So let's start with, I think you said it fell into your lap or you just came across it by accident. I don't believe in luck. You know, there'll be lots of people listening that think, well, I've never had a fantastic development deal drop in my lap. And that's obviously because you take lots of action, Ian, and you do lots of marketing. How did you actually come across this vendor?
Okay, well, to say it came to me by accident is probably not quite true, but it came to me from a deal source that I've been in touch with for probably 3 or 4 years. It's someone that I've spoken to who's asked quite a lot about what I do, understands how we help people, understands a little bit about my background, and she's introduced deals to me before. They haven't been particularly great, and then she just happened to call me up one day and said, I've got someone which might be interesting, would you like to take a look at it? So it really was as simple as that. I wasn't particularly looking in this area at the time, but it turned out to be a really good deal.
And so the deal sourcer showed you what the numbers on the deal, told you a little bit about the property?
So she had a fairly close relationship with the vendor, and she brought it to me and said, look, this house has been on the market. They had it on at the beginning of last year. They're in a fairly sticky situation, and I wondered if this was something you'd like to look at. So it was as simple as that.
This happened loads where a deal sourcer will contact a prospective investor, and a load of due diligence takes place, and then the deal falls over. And I know you've probably had hundreds of those as well, Ian.
One or two.
But this one's progressed. So I want to get into the guts of that a little bit. What information did the sourcer give you, and what information did they not have to hand? Because I'm guessing you then started talking to the vendor and uncovered a lot for yourself. So what were they sharing with you up front before you'd paid any money?
So the basic information I had was the address of the property. I had the estate agent's details when it was on the market at the beginning of last year. And I had some due diligence, very basic due diligence from the deal sourcer of what the local agents thought it would sell for and what her estimate of the value was at the time. And that was about it, really. It was fairly basic, rudimentary information.
But interesting that the deal source was willing to give you the full address. That shows that you had a fair amount of trust with her, I'm guessing.
Yes, I did, yeah. As I say, I mean, I've known her for a few years. We talk on and off about various things. She regularly brings things to me and asks me questions, and I'm happy to help her as well. So,
and is this the first deal you've actually done with this sourcer, though?
Yes, it is, actually, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a long time to be fostering a relationship. But I imagine she gets value from chatting to you. She gets the value of your expertise. And of course, you're hoping she's going to bring you a deal, which after 3 or 4 years has actually happened, which is great. So let's look at this information. Was it still on the market when she was presenting it to you, or had it been taken off?
No, it had been taken off. It was only on the market for about 2 months at the beginning of last year, pre-lockdown. It had struggled to sell, and they'd taken it off the market. I think they were a little bit concerned about the market. I think there were underlying factors there which still haven't completely come to light, but it was off market.
And so tell me the numbers that the source was presenting you with, like what presumably she was telling you what it had been marketed at, and then you said she'd said that it might sell for this. What numbers were you presented with?
So she said it had been on the market at 420,000 and they'd had some interest. The local agents expected it to sell for somewhere around about 400,000. And her estimate of the value was probably a little bit less than that. She said she thought about 375, maybe 380,000.
So we'll keep those numbers in mind as we go through the deal. You mentioned that the sourcer had said that the vendor was in a bit of a sticky situation. Did she elaborate? Did she know what the situation was?
She just said that the property was in a fairly poor condition. They were both, the vendors were working both full time. One of them was traveling an hour and a half to work each day. They needed to move the, I think it was the mother-in-law lived in the house. There was an annex to this house and they just needed to move on. The house hadn't sold and they were a little bit concerned about that, and that was it.
Was there any mention of fees at that point? How did the sourcer protect their deal, basically?
It was done really on trust, believe it or not. We had a very broad conversation at the very outset about fees, and it was a fixed fee. It wasn't really based on the profit or anything like that. I agreed to it.
And what was the fee?
£9,000.
Wow, quite a chunky fee. Yeah. And was that her first request, or was it non-negotiable, or did you negotiate? How did that come about?
We talked about a share of the profit. We talked about a percentage based on profit, and she wanted the certainty of knowing that there was a fee that was there and exactly what she was going to get. We came to this agreement. I can't remember how, if I'm honest. But we plucked this figure out of the air, and the £9,000 was agreed.
Okay, fantastic. So what happened next? You agreed £9,000, you looked at the deal, and presumably you said to her, yeah, I think this might have legs, I'm interested. What happened next?
So I then had a call with the vendors and introduced myself, told them who I was, told them how I'd got in contact with them, and just really tried to understand exactly what their situation was, and explained what I thought I could do with the property and the garden. And we reached a very broad agreement in that initial call, really, of what we thought might look like a deal, and then arranged to go down for a visit about a week later.
I know this deal, and I've obviously walked alongside you as you've done it. Yeah. So I'm trying not to leap to conclusions there. So let me take it a few steps back. The sourcer has said this property was on the market for 420. It's probably worth 375, 380, and the vendors are motivated. You agreed the £9,000 after a few discussions. Did you sign a contract with the sourcer or anything like that, or was that just done on an email exchange?
Yeah, just an exchange of emails.
Yeah, perfect, which is nice. I like the trust in that. She then gave you the vendor's number, presumably told the vendor you were going to be calling them. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
And so that initial conversation on the EPP, we call it a telephone fact find, how long did it take?
It was probably no more than about 15 minutes, really. I mean, it was a fairly standard, what we'd call a TFF, really.
And so what were you offering? Presumably you weren't offering a BMV solution in 28 days. Presumably you're offering a control now, pay later. How did you, we know what the deal ended up being, but, and I know you'll share that shortly, but how did you simplify that? I think this is what people who want to get into sophisticated property investing, but haven't done any SPI deals to date, really struggle with. How do you not confuse the vendor completely and lose them in a cloud of just confusion? How did you present? Because here's the conundrum I think a lot of investors have. They haven't seen the property. You've not seen the property. All you've done probably is go up and down Google Street View. You've looked at the listing previously. You've just mentioned about the garden and stuff. So you've done a fair bit of due diligence, but you've not seen it yet. And neither have you met the vendor. So what did you cover in that 15 minutes to say, yes, I'm willing to drive there? Because let's be honest, it's quite a drive. How many hours drive is it from where you live?
It's probably nearly 6 hours, actually.
So it's a 6 hour, it's a 12-hour round trip to get there and back. You don't want to get there and then go, yeah, I don't think so, Ian.
Yeah.
We haven't got time for a coffee, mate, but thanks for popping by. Yeah. So what did you cover in that 15 minutes that made you think, yes, this has got some legs, it's worth me going down there?
So I'd done a little bit of due diligence before I'd gone down there. As I'd mentioned the garden, I looked at the garden and I thought, the garden looks like it's big enough that I could build a house on here. And my initial approach to it was, I wonder if I could get planning permission on this to build either one house or two, because the garden actually wraps around the house. So it's large enough on one side for one house, and on the opposite side of the house, it's probably big enough for a smaller house. So initially I'd looked at it. I looked at the local development plan, spoke to an architect friend of mine and said, what do you think? And he said, yes, it's got legs. You know, it's not in a conservation area. There doesn't seem to be anything which I'd be particularly alarmed about. So I'd had a chat with the vendor just to really try and understand exactly what the problem was and to see if I could find a solution that would suit their needs, really, rather than me dictating the deal, saying this is what I can offer. So initially we talked about the straightforward BMV deal, as you suggested, that wasn't going to work for them.
What did you offer there? What price were you looking at?
Oh, goodness, I can't remember now. I think it was about 290, I think. It just wasn't going to work for them at all.
It's going to be around the 300 mark, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't going to work for them. They said that the mother and all lived in the house. They just needed to move on. They wanted to downsize. They had a fairly small mortgage relative to the value of the house. Remember, it was just over 200,000. And I explained my background and what I did and said that my approach to this would be that I would give them, I would do a fairly significant refurbishment on the house, and that would all be at my expense. And I would be happy for them to take a share of the increase in the value of the property. And that would give them an uplift in the overall sum that they received at the end of the day. The conversation moved on. They said, well, you know, we don't really have much money. And would you be able to pay our rent for somewhere else? And I said, yep, you know, we can work something into that. That's no problem at all. So we agreed on the phone that the broad bones of this deal looked like it was going to be a fairly straightforward assisted sale deal. And so I went through the numbers with them and said, look, you know, I'm probably thinking this is going to work something like this. You'll receive £350,000. I'll do the refurbishment and then we'll split the profit over and above that once I've got my refurbishment money back. They ummed and ahed and said, it's worth having a conversation with about. I said, okay, you know, I'd be delighted to come down and talk to you about it in a little bit more detail. But as long as you understand that, you know, that's the basis of the agreement that I'm coming down with, it does that work for you? Yes, they said, that's fine. Come down and let's have a chat. So that's what we did. It was a very basic conversation, but at least they had an idea of the approach that I was taking to it from the start.
Okay. So my initial thoughts are, as a vendor, if I'm putting myself in your vendor situation, I was hoping for my house to sell for 420. It was on the market for a couple of months at 420 a short while ago, and I've now taken it off the market. You're offering me 350 plus a share of profit. Surely they ask you then, well, what do you think it will sell for? What are you going to spend on it? Did you discuss those numbers?
Yeah. Again, I'd gone back and I'd had a broad conversation with the deal sourcer who knew the area quite well. She said post refurb it would probably sell for 525, maybe even as much as 550. Obviously I hadn't seen the house. All I had was the estate agent's details and some pictures of what looked like it was a fairly tired and run down house. So the conversation I'd had with the vendor was, look, I would do this. It's going to be a fairly big refurbishment. I'm guessing from the pictures it's going to be somewhere in the order of about £50,000. So you get your 350, I'll spend my 50 and we'll share the profits. If it sells for 500 or 550, then you get another 50,000 on top of that. If it goes for 550, then you would get 75,000 on top of your 350. So
they're thinking if it sells for 500, they've got their 400, which is what they're probably hoping for. But if it sells for 550, then they've got their 425, which is even more than they're hoping for. So there's an upside in it for them. Is that basically where they got to?
Yes. And I said, and we would look to apply for planning permission on the garden as well. And there may be something that we can do to work in some increase in value and a share of that for you as well.
The house will hopefully give them 400 to 425. But then if you can get planning gain on the plot, then that's a bonus for them and they might get a bit more out of that as well. That's where you got to on that TFF call, was
it? Yes, that was it.
One thing that you glossed over massively here, which I think I just want to highlight for the listeners, and that is that you called an architect friend of yours And that's so valuable. You don't want to incur hundreds of pounds of costs. You don't want to instruct an architect to do a report and a survey and all that. You just need a bit of insider knowledge on, is this likely to work or not? And he gave you the nod and said, yeah, that will work. And it's that relationship of, if you've used someone a lot, if they know they're going to get the work, you know, I probably bounce 4 deals off my architect for every one that I do with him. But the one that I do, he might earn 5,000-10,000 pounds off it, and he's more than happy to spend half an hour on each of the other 3 or 4 deals. So I think I just wanted to highlight that, Ian, that because you've got that power team, you can pick up the phone and get a ballpark figure from your different professionals, which is really helpful. So excellent. So you had that telephone fact find. How soon after that did you go down and meet with them?
It was about a week later.
Okay, brilliant. Did you write to them, email them? Did you build rapport in any way between those two dates?
Yeah, so the same day that we'd done the TFF, I sent them a letter and said, you know, it was great to talk to you, looking forward to meeting you next week. This is what I'll do when I'm down there. I'll have a good look around the house and we'll sit down and agree the numbers. I gave them a call, I think probably about 3 or 4 days before, and just said, you know, just checking what the parking is like in the street. I knew exactly what it was like, but I just wanted to call them to chat anyway. And then sent them a text the day before just to say, you know, I see you at whatever time it was. I think it was about 6 o'clock in the evening. So three points of contact before we went down.
In the course of a week, yeah. Which is great. Plus the warm referral from the sourcer, yeah. Plus the 15 minutes on the phone for the TFF. Great. So they're super warm in terms of rapport. They've seen your letterhead paper and they're feeling that you're professional. So you popped down there for your help visit. Uh-huh. How did that go?
Yeah, it was really good, actually. I went down and met the vendors. I'm trying to think of, on that first visit, I think I met with my building contractor as well. So it was slightly unusual because I knew that it was a large refurbishment. I really wanted someone to have a look over it before I started giving certain figures to the vendor. So I'd arranged to meet the vendors and have a coffee and a chat with them for, I think it was about an hour, and then arranged for a contractor friend of mine to come along an hour later to have a really good look around the house with me. Hmm. So, yeah, it was an interesting first meeting. It was all very good and straightforward. We just chatted about golf and moving houses and all sorts of things like that. And it was pretty straightforward, to be honest, Frank. They were quite open with me and said, look, you know, we just haven't had the money to spend on the house. I'd had a good look around and said, you know, it's a fairly significant refurbishment. It's a kitchen, it's a bathroom. It had a thatched roof. I said, we'll need to do that. The drive was in a bit of a mess. The boiler bonnet was on its last legs. It had this funny arrangement with a kind of an annex at the side, and so on and so on. So I was walking around and I kind of had my notebook. I'm adding things up and I'm thinking, yeah, this is going to be more than 50,000. Actually, I was probably thinking it was going to be closer to 70 or 80. And so my builder contractor came along. He had a really good look around the house with me. We walked around together for half an hour. And he said, I think you probably could be looking closer to 100,000 on this, actually. He said, there's all sorts of things that need doing. It had some very dated, there was some Artex on the ceilings. It had those, you know, beams, which are kind of almost just like glued to the ceiling rather than that are made to look like oak beams.
It sounds lovely.
Lovely, yeah. Had a kind of a 1980s kitchen, a bathroom which had been ripped out and there was a leak, a little bit of subsidence at the back of the house. There were numerous problems. I mean, it was a big job, clearly, at that point.
I'm intrigued as to the order, actually, that you did this in. So you sat down with them and chatted about golf and built rapport, which is great, 6 till 7. Then your builder turned up 7 till 8. At what point did you, you know, start talking numbers with them?
So the builder then had left and we then had another few cups of tea and chatted.
Ah, perfect.
So it was just the three of us, actually two vendors and me. And I just started talking a little bit more detail. I said, look, builder thinks it's going to be close to 100,000. and this is what the numbers would look like. And we talked it through. Again, I said, look, you know, it's a really lovely house on a great plot. I think the house could probably be worth $550,000. And we're actually thinking about spending $100,000 on the house. And there is obviously the possibility of getting planning permission on the garden for a building plot. And that could bring us $60,000 to $80,000, which obviously would share as well. So again, we ran through the numbers and I said, look, happy to do this on a 50-50 share basis with you. And again, she asked if I would cover her rent and her bills. I said, yeah, that's absolutely fine. We'll just put that, all of that into the mixing pot as well. And so we agreed heads of terms. I just hand wrote it out in my notebook and I signed it. They signed it and off we went, instructed the solicitors. And I thought that that was going to be the beginning of a straightforward process, but you know, these things never quite are. But
yeah. We'll get on to the less than straightforward bits in a minute, but yeah. I love that. So you've written the heads of terms in front of them, handwritten, which is the EPP system, really effective for mutual ownership and buy-in from the vendor. I like that they signed it, because then when you give it to the solicitors know that both parties are on the same page. The numbers now then are looking like they're getting the first 350, you're spending 100, and then you're aiming for 550 sale price. So now there's only 400 in it for them. Is that right?
We actually changed the heads of terms because I was a little bit concerned about what I was going to uncover in this house. So I changed the heads of terms and said, okay, the way that we're going to structure this is that the order of priority for the distribution of funds is that I get my money back first for the refurbishment and all of the costs, because they wanted moving costs in, rent and mortgage and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I would get my money back first, and everything then above 400,000, which was left as profit, we would then split.
Okay, so it's got quite significantly better for you then, hasn't it? Yeah,
yeah, much better.
So how much is their rent a month?
It's just over 1,100, 1,150 a month.
Okay, and then you've got some professional fees, etc. So what were you estimating your total cost to be, like 120 or something?
Yeah, a little bit over. I was thinking probably 120, maybe even as much as 150 at that point.
Okay, so let's just assume it's 125 then, as an example. So you're thinking it's going to sell,
yeah.
You're going to get 125,
yeah.
They're then going to get their 350?
Yeah.
No, they're not getting 350 anymore. They're getting the balance to 400, is that
That's right?
Right,
yeah.
So they're going to get 275, 275 and 125 is 400, yeah. So they're going to get 275, and then the balance above 400 is 50-50.
That's right, yes.
So if it's sold for 550, then there's 75 each. They got 275 plus 75 is 300. So they're only getting 350 now. So they, before you got there, and this is important, some people listening might think, oh, you know, Ian, you've moved the goalpost, but you're just making the best estimate at this, at each stage, aren't you? You know, before you've seen the house, you're estimating it. And then when you've seen the house, you're estimating it. And it's still not, you're not offering them a fixed amount. You're still saying, you know, it depends what it sells for. And these deals evolve. But what I'm interested in is, how have they gone from 425 on the phone to 350 in the course of basically 3 hours, an hour with them, an hour with your builder, another hour with them. How did that happen? And was there resistance? Did they begrudge it? Were they understanding? Or how would you sum that up?
There wasn't really any resistance. I just explained to them that if we did it the way that I'd thought about doing it originally, they would probably come out with less than I was predicting. And by doing it this way, if we then got planning permission on the plot and so on, that actually they would get more. So we ran through the numbers. I set the two scenarios out and explained, having had my builder contractor along there, that there was a lot of work here. There wasn't just, you know, a big refurbishment. This was a lot of work. And they were quite accepting of that. And quite happy with it, and that's why they were happy to sign up to it.
And I guess from their perspective, you've got a lot of skin in the game. You're now putting in 100, 125 grand into their property that they own. Yep. But also you're paying their rent for them, you're paying their bills, you're solving their issue immediately, aren't you? Which is massive for someone who's motivated. Yep. So you wrote your heads of terms. Yep. What happened next?
So the solicitors were instructed in, I'm trying to think of the timescale, I guess that must have been end of October, early November.
And how long between that and when you were first presented the deal from the sourcer?
A week and a half.
Really quick then, so you're moving swiftly. And that's the thing, these good deals, they don't hang around. You've got to jump on them. So the sourcer gave it to you. You spoke to the sourcer, arranged the deal, spoke to the vendor, booked in to go and see them. So we're 10 days later and you've got heads of terms signed. That is brilliant, mate. And people go, oh, you know, you're lucky. No, you're not lucky. You you make your own luck by being by being an action taker and being decisive. In fact, I've just done a training session with two new country owners in EPP. Wow. They're doing their first ever discovery day today, which is when a few people, no more than five people, spend a few hours with us deciding whether to come on as a member. And you'll remember many years ago, Ian, coming on as a member for for your 4 month trial. Yes. I can actually remember you being very reluctant to come and meet me, Ian.
I probably was, actually. You know me.
You came to our offices in Derbyshire, and you were like, I'm not sure I'm going to learn anything from you, Frank. Yeah. And I remembered what I had to do. I said to you, I said, pay for it. I can't remember what I charged you for the one-to-one. And after an hour, if you're not convinced I can help you, you can leave and get a full refund. Do you remember that?
I think I probably do, actually.
Yeah. And I remember stopping it after an hour and said, so do you want to carry on? And you're like, yeah, I'm all right to carry on now. We're good. I don't need my refund. Okay. But what I said to these new two guys this morning, so they're doing it now, actually, as we're speaking, was I think you should be brave and say to the guys that are on this discovery day, they've paid £500, refundable, but £500 commitment for their seat at the table this morning to find out about the EPP 4 month trial. And it's £3,000 for the trial. And I said to the guys, if they can't decide in a 4 hour meeting, that's how long is it allocated to this discovery morning. Uh-huh. If they can't decide in 4 hours, bearing in mind they've already had a conversation with them, they've already done some due diligence, they already know that it's £3,000 for 4 months, they know there's 61 SPI strategies that they can tap into, etc. If after all of that and being able to ask questions today, they've got a partner, a recent partner coming on board to ask them questions, if they still can't decide, then I think you should tell them they can't come on board. And the guys committed to it. I was quite proud of them, actually. I said at the start of the morning, say it's this much. And at the end of today, there are only two outcomes. One is you decide to come on board and we book you in to start your 4 months. And the second outcome is you decide it's not for you. And both of those are absolutely fine. But if you're in the camp where you still can't make a decision, you know, you still need to speak to someone or you still need to think about it, then we're going to say, sorry, but you're not right for EPP, because you're never going to actually do a deal. And that's why I tell this brief story, Ian. Wow. You've taken decisive action. We'll come on to how much you've made from this deal. But we've got a pretty good idea already, but you can only do this. You can only earn £50,000, £100,000 on a deal if you can back yourself. And if you can't back yourself to invest £3,000 and 4 months of your life into your own development, then you're not going to be able to make £100,000 on a deal. So congratulations, mate. That is really swift action taken. Can I ask a question? Yeah. This I know you very well. So does that come naturally to you, that decisiveness, that taking swift action, or do you have to consciously alter your personality profile to do that?
I know exactly where you're going with this.
I've got a little smirk on my face.
I can hear it in your voice. No, it doesn't. Whether that's an age thing or whether it's just me or whether it's past experiences or whatever it is, As you know, I mean, I was slow to join up. I possibly came on the discovery day, as it was at the time, you know, maybe a little bit cynical, maybe a little bit arrogant.
Every time Ian says maybe a little, read lots, lots cynical, lots, lots of that. Carry on, mate. Sorry, I'm just mocking you here.
So, you know, when I came onto it, I thought, well, I've got all this experience in commercial property. I've got all this experience buying lots of residential property, doing lots of refurbishments. What can I possibly learn from someone who is 10 years younger than me? You know, this kind of upstart who kind of knows it all. And actually, the you know, the reality of the situation was that I came into it with my eyes only kind of half open, really. I was at a place where I'd just lost a little bit of direction and I just needed something to latch on to. And I liked you and I liked the partnership. I liked the people on it. And the things that I've learned, I, as you know, I mean, I'm not interested in building my residential portfolio anymore, really. There are other things that I'm interested in doing, which I'm spending my time on. And the value in joining up and, you know, I know exactly where you're going with this, with disc profiles and so on, is just tremendous. And I would never have thought about doing a deal like this 4 or 5 years ago. It just wouldn't really even occur to me. No, it would have been a straightforward, I'm going to buy the house, I'm just going to do the refurbishment myself and fund it all by myself. It would never have even occurred to me to do it as an assisted sale with a development angle to it either. I just would never have crossed my mind.
If you just factor in, how many months is it going to be between breaking ground or starting the works and actually getting paid from the sale? How long is that time period going to be?
So the refurbishment is finishing tomorrow. Actually, I'm going down to Suffolk today. And so the house will be going on the market tomorrow. We're hoping that it sells quickly. We've had lots of interest pre-market already. And we got planning permission on the plot last week. So we're with a QS at the moment and the architect getting figures together. We're hoping to break ground on that as soon as the main house is sold. So probably sometime, I hope, around about June, July time. It's a pretty straightforward plot. Access is good. It's a straightforward build. It's not a big house. I would hope that that's built and sold by, well, certainly built by the end of the year. We'll have to see what impact, you know, is everything has on the market later this year. But yeah, I would hope by the end of the year, everything is built and the main house has been sold.
So we're pushing up towards 18 months there, aren't we, start to finish?
Yeah, maybe a little bit less, maybe 15 months probably, yeah.
Cool, so let's go with 15 months. The point I'm highlighting is if you had bought this yourself, you've got best part of 400 grand, maybe 350 you would have got it down to. Stamp duty on that, you've got legals, you've got finance on 350 grand for 15 months whilst you're doing it. That just takes such a bite out of your deal. I was looking for 3 months of bridging on a deal down in London, actually, £500,000 purchase recently. Only for 3 months. And by the time they'd added in all of their fees, we were looking at over £40,000 in costs. And it just blows it out of the water. It's absolutely crazy in terms of the potential, you know, eating into your profitability. So you'd done your heads of terms, you'd instructed lawyers within 10 days, which is brilliant. That's typically the bit where it slows down slightly. What happened next?
So it did slow down, and it slowed down quite a lot, actually. We'd agreed a specification with the builder and the vendors and set out everything that we proposed doing. At one point, we were looking at ripping all the internal walls out and completely reconfiguring the whole of the interior of the house. But every single time we stopped and questioned, is this actually adding value to the building? Is this money well spent? And eventually we agreed a specification, which was really just a very large refurbishment. It was keeping largely the layout of the house as it was, albeit that the annex would turn into two bedrooms. So it would turn from a three-bedroom house to a five-bedroom house. That was all done. That was all agreed. We'd kind of agreed a start date with the vendors of the beginning of January. But the solicitors just were taking forever. And the vendors were very slow. and they were not very responsive. I was trying to keep the contact up with them. So that was probably the beginning of November. And by the middle of December, we had an agreed contract, but it wasn't signed by the vendors. There were still a couple of things which were ticking along, which hadn't quite got over the line. So the deal hadn't still completed, actually, by the middle of December, just before Christmas.
Am I right in saying you'd cracked on with works by then?
The work was due to start literally the first week in January. I think it was about the 2nd or 3rd of January. So I started on site by then, yet.
So that's a bit nerve-wracking because, you know, do you start works in good faith or do you wait for the signatures? What did you go with? How did you resolve it?
The contractor, he's well known to me. So, but he'd cleared his diary, you know, he was doing me a big favour. He'd got all the guys ready and everything to start on site at the beginning of January. And we got to December, it still wasn't signed. I was in touch with him almost on a daily basis between Christmas and New Year. And we took the view that this probably is still going to complete, you know, the first week or so in January. So I said, look, just crack on, just get the work started. And hopefully this will get to a point where within a few days, at least, there's that the agreement is signed and this will all be legal and binding.
And was it?
No.
and here we come to some of the potholes and the hurdles that we have to overcome. And it's never easy, is it, Ian? Because if it were easy, everyone would be doing them. There wouldn't be tens of thousands of pounds of profit to be made. So what happened and how did you resolve it?
So the delays went on, actually. And the guys on site were absolutely ripping through this place at a rate of knots. Within the first week, all of the old carpets were up. The kitchen had been ripped out. The bathroom had been ripped out. They'd had the clay lump. It's a kind of a specialist kind of construction. Think about Watland daub. It's like mud mixed with hair and straw. The clay lump specialist had been in. The windows were being measured up. The house had just been ripped apart within the first week. The agreement still wasn't signed. And that ran through until the second week. Again, the work was pushing on at a rate of knots.
Out of interest, I'm just thinking about this from I remember we worked through it at the time because you and I were talking quite regularly about, you know, what should you do here? Should you stop? Should you lose your builder? Obviously, you've got to pay him for what he's done. So if you pause him and he has to go find another job, you know, that could take 3-4 months to get him back on site. Should you carry on? But I guess the one bit of leverage, and I'm guessing this is the vendors being slightly awkward now. Is that a fair representation? Why had it not been signed?
It's difficult to say, and I'm still not quite clear. They definitely were being slow. As I say, one of them worked an hour and a half away each day and worked a 10-hour shift, so it was a very long day for them. And she was the primary contact. He worked, I think, about 45 minutes away, but wasn't that responsive either. I don't think there was a problem with them. But I think the problem was simply just down to the solicitors and her working hours. It was just nigh on impossible for her.
Just logistics of it.
It was just the logistics of it.
I guess the one bit of leverage you had, though, was you were in it for a week or two's building costs, which is not insignificant, but it's not, you know, going to be too painful. They, on the other hand, had got a habitable house that is now very, very far from habitable. So if it all dissolved and they decided not to sign, you would walk away with no key undertaking in place, you know, no responsibility, presumably, and they were left with a house that needed a lot of money spending on it that they didn't have. So I guess you kind of had that safety net. Am I right in saying that, Ian?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the broad conversations I'd had with them at the time. I said, you know, look, I've got a funder involved here, and the funder is threatening to withdraw funding because we haven't got the agreement signed.
They'd rather not donate to your DIY project. They'd like to see a return. They'd like to see their money back at some point, yeah, please. Yeah.
So, you know, there was that possibility. I said, look, you know, we just need to get this over the line. I said, I don't want to pull the builders off site either. Everybody's under pressure. And is there anything I can do to help? So we'd had this conversation probably 2 or 3 times over the course of a couple of weeks. And it was getting towards, I can't remember what the date now was now, but it was about the 18th, 19th of January. So we were well into January at this point. And I knew there wasn't an issue with the agreement itself. The solicitors had told me that the agreement was agreed, but it wasn't signed. So you and I'd have a conversation at the time, and I remember it at the time, and you said, what do you think the possibility is that this deal is going to go ahead still? And I said, oh, I don't think I'm still 80, 90%. And you said, I'm at 50%, less than. And I was like, oh God, right, okay. I've got to get in the car and I've got to do it tomorrow and I've got to drive down there and I've got to pin them down. So I think it was a Sunday actually. And so I called them up and said, look, I've got the agreement here. I'm happy for you to print a copy off as well. But I'm going to come down and, you know, we just need to get this done now. And that's exactly what I did. So 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning, drove down to Suffolk, met them, got a cup of tea at the house. They had a look around, saw the destruction that had taken place so far. And sure enough, and they signed it on the spot. We had a witness there who witnessed it for us as well. And I got back in the car and drove the 6 hours back up north again. So,
and sighed a big sigh of relief, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just out of interest, if they'd walked away at that point and said, you know what, we've changed our mind, or we've just won the lottery or whatever, how much would you have lost at that point?
It was about, I think about £16,000-£17,000 at the time.
Yeah, and that's it. You need to, it's in the same vein as that decisiveness. I've lent vendors money before now. I've had vendors phone me up and say, please, can I have a few £1,000? And I remember having the conversation with my wife. They asked for it on a Sunday. This particular vendor asked for it. It's £2,000 or something. And she asked for it on a Sunday and said, please, can I have it today? And I was like, A, it's a Sunday. B, we're completing on like Friday next week, you know, so we're less than a week away. And C, I can't possibly put any like protection in place for me. You just want me to give you £2,000. And I did it. I said, here's what it'll have to be, you know, to warrant me leaving my family. She was about an hour away from my house. To warrant me leaving my family for the day and the risk, etc., I'll give you £2,000 today. I'll drive over and give it to you cash, but we need to knock £4,000 off the purchase price. And she went for it. It was that important to her. And I did a loan agreement, same thing. Did a witness, a neighbour came around and witnessed it. If she pulled out of the completion, she owed me the £4,000 as well. So it wasn't linked to that. I just suddenly got nervous that there maybe was she's trying to be, you know, clever about it and pull a fast one. But that's it. It's that commitment to the deal, isn't it, Ian? You know, and commitment to the vendor, and you went down and got it saved. But also the commitment you showed was that £16,000-£17,000 outlay without a signed agreement. And I'd never recommend that for anyone. I'm not saying be kamikaze, be reckless, but at the same time, you can't do this with zero risk. This business requires a certain appetite for risk. We minimize it as much as possible. So congratulations, mate. So you got it signed. Yeah. And what have you done since? You obviously then cracked on with it. Where have you got to with it? You finished the refurb, but what did it cost? What did the, it's not a refurb really. It's a complete reconfiguration, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, what has that cost?
It's a redevelopment. I'm saying a redevelopment. That makes it sound bigger than it really is, but it's actually a really big refurbishment. But yeah, I mean, everything's finishing off tomorrow. The guys have been on site, you know, 12 hours a day for the last week and a half to try and get everything finished off in time for me. So the total costs, I think we're at about 129,000 at the minute.
You're pretty accurate with your estimation, yeah.
Yeah. The costs for, there's been a few costs which we hadn't quite accounted for. We had to put a septic tank in the plot. We had to put one at the back of the house, actually, because the septic tank for the house was actually in the plot. So it was actually cheaper to put a new septic tank in. So that was about, I think, about £8,000. Applied for planning. There's, you know, various things that have been associated with the getting the plot ready, I guess. So those costs are probably about another 30,000.
On top of the 129.
On top of the 129, yeah. So I think all in, we're probably going to be a total of somewhere in the order of about 175,000 or so, I would think. Maybe a few grand more, but 175-ish.
Cool. What are you marketing it at the house when it goes on next week?
So I'm meeting the estate agents first thing tomorrow morning. Initial indications, or certainly the last time I was down there 4 or 5 weeks ago, they were thinking 600,000, maybe
Brilliant.
A bit more. With interest from people who've been walking up and down the street, who've been in touch, asking when it's going on the market. And so I'm hopeful it's going to be a minimum of 600. It might go for a little bit more. So that's a pretty good price, I think.
And how many building plots have you got for free? Did you get two, or have you got the one?
So we'll keep the two. We've only got planning on one at the moment. We didn't want to kind of overwhelm the area with too many building plots, or kind of hem this house in and have two building sites all at once in one go. So we've got the planning on the main plot. Once the main house is sold and we've started building the first one, then we'll go for planning on the second one.
How many bedroom property detached? I'm guessing it's detached. How many bedrooms is it?
Four bedrooms. It's like a dormer bungalow.
Brilliant. And what are your numbers on that? What's it going to cost you to build it? What will it be worth?
So we're waiting for the QS to come back on this. We've estimated about 160,000. Anything less than that would be a bonus. And GDV, the resale price on this house, will be about 450.
Cool, that's looking nice, isn't it? That's a nice, healthy profit on that. If the first one sells for 600, how much is in that for you?
Not a lot. I mean, I think we'd probably come out with about 20,000, but the intention never really was to make a great deal from the main house. Actually, we're going to change the agreement ever so slightly with the vendor, so that rather than getting them getting a share of the increase in value on the plot with planning, they'll obviously have to pay capital gains on that, because their PPR, the main house, they won't have to pay tax on, obviously.
Yes.
So we're going to change it, and we're just going to say, well, look, you just keep the profit from the house, and then we'll just keep the plots.
Okay. So you're not even going to take your 20. That's going to be their uplift.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah.
Brilliant. And they happy with that in principle?
Yeah, in principle, yeah. We're just going to nail that down tomorrow, but I'm 99% sure they'll go for that.
Brilliant. So no profit from the house and a lot of work, but what you've done is created two plots for yourself. So on the first plot, if it's 160 in and 450 as a sale price, there's 290K profit there. Just knocked 100 grand off of your deal there. Sorry, mate. And what about the other plot? Is that very similar?
It's much smaller, actually. So that one, we'll probably get a planning on for a two-bedroom detached cottage. So we're thinking on that, that's build cost probably somewhere in the order of 100 to 120,000, and GDV around about 275. So around about 150 to 175 profit on that.
Wow. Looking at about 450 in total, is that about right?
Yeah.
And did I hear you earlier say that you've bought financiers in on this? How much of your own money have you put in?
I haven't put a huge amount in, actually. I've got a couple of investors who've loaned me the majority of the money. I'm going to end up doing a joint venture with the contractor who's doing all the work at the moment on this. Because we've got another one which is similar to this, not far away, for five houses, actually. And so we're going to joint venture on that. And as part of that agreement, he's put part of the funding in for this as well. So I'm only on this one, actually, for about 20,000 of my own money.
Well, that's amazing. So you put 20 grand in, plus a lot of elbow grease in setting it up and overseeing the works and that. And you're looking at 440 out.
Yeah.
Over the next what? With the second development, that's going to be another. How long before you're done with this and walked away with all your profit, do you reckon?
I would guess probably another year, I would think.
And we're already in at the moment for just under a year, is that right?
Yeah.
So in and out completely within 2 years, even with a big margin of error there.
Yeah.
20 grand in and 440 out. Is it going to be less than 440 because you're going to give some to the builder, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what will your total profit be if it goes to plan?
I think for my share of that will be somewhere in the order of about 300,000.
300, that's amazing, Ian. What a phenomenal deal. 20 grand in and 300 grand out over the space of 2 years.
Yeah.
And you let slip there. This isn't your only development. You've got multiples going on. In fact, we're buying a commercial property, aren't we, up in Nottinghamshire together as a JV at the moment. So your fingers in many pies and many deals going on. But that's the beauty of an SPI business. You don't have to be swapping time for money. You can spend a day like you are tomorrow setting everything up, and then an hour a week keeping on top of it, and have multiples of those going on. Oh. Ian, that is a fantastic deal, mate. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, warts and all. Have we missed anything that's relevant? Is there anything you want to add to this particular deal?
No, I mean, it's been a learning experience for me. I mean, we talk on the partnership a lot about disk profiles, and I've been very conscious of this when I've been dealing with the vendors. I think the biggest takeaway for me really has been very conscious of working with the vendors and just providing that right solution for them, but being very, very conscious of their disk profile. And that's paid dividends in the end. I'm absolutely delighted with the deal. I really am. It's the best deal that I've done. And as I said to you earlier, I wouldn't have done this. You know, I wouldn't have even thought about structuring it like this 4 or 5 years ago. So, yeah, I'm absolutely delighted with it.
How long ago did you come on EPP, mate?
4 and a bit years ago. Four and a bit years ago.
I think you're in cohort 2, actually, from memory. Hence the grandfather of EPP reference.
Yeah.
I'll just slide that in there again.
Finish it off, isn't it?
Top and tail it with a joke at Ian's expense, exactly. Hey, mate, always a pleasure to chat, and thank you for sharing your wisdom. Thanks for sharing your experience with us and the EPP audience. Best of luck with this deal, and best of luck with your future deals, mate. Looking forward to many celebrations with you in the future. You deserve all of your success, Ian Taylor.
No problem. Thanks very much, mate. Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.